Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have Alyssa Ayers with us today to talk about the recent earthquakes in Nepal and the challenges of rebuilding there. Dr. Ayers is CFR Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia. From 2010 to 2013, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia. And prior to that, she led the Indian South Asia practice at McClarty Associates, the Washington-based international strategic advisory firm. She has co-edited 3 books on India and Indian foreign policy, and her book on nationalism, culture, and politics in Pakistan, Speaking Like a State, received the American Institute of Pakistan Studies Book Prize for 2011 to 2012. She writes regularly for the CFR blog Asia Unbound and is a contributor to Forbes.com. You can also follow her on Twitter at AyersAlyssa. So, Alyssa, thank you very much for joining us today. Nepal was already devastated on April 25th by that tremendous earthquake, and just this Tuesday suffered a significant aftershock. It's not good news. Can you talk about the domestic and international response to date and the challenges that lie ahead for rebuilding there?
Sure. And I was happy to see so many people registered for this call, though, of course, I feel terrible that the occasion for the call is this calamity that has befallen Nepal. And as you just said, just as the 13-day mourning period from the first earthquake finishes, another earthquake hits the country. I thought I could go over some of the stats at the top and then move into some of the concerns as Nepal moves into now this mode of trying to think about handling the rebuilding transition. And I just will provide the caveat that, again, the statistics continue to change. So if we were to look at numbers from last week about the numbers of fatalities, of course, it's up by another 1,500 or so now this week. So I'll just start with some of the statistics, and then we can move on to some of the other issues. And I understand as well we have some participants on the call who have just returned from Nepal, so look forward to firsthand reports from those participants as well. April 25th, the first major earthquake hit Nepal. That was a 7.8 earthquake on the Richter scale, located with an epicenter a little bit northwest of Kathmandu, sort of the capital city and the kind of most populous part of Nepal, right in the Kathmandu Valley. As of today, as of the latest news reports, there are an estimated more than 8,000 people who have been killed as a result of the earthquake, more than 17,000 injured. That number seems to be ticking upwards. The last I saw was 17,860, and reports of more than 600,000 homes destroyed. This is a country with a population of about 30,600,000 homes. That's a lot of homes that have been destroyed. The United Nations, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, and I'm using a lot of their statistical reporting here, they provide regular updates on a practically daily basis, has noted the UN has done what they call a flash appeal for assistance. The flash appeal goal is $423 million. Now, the bad news is that so far that's only 10% funded, so we'll come back to this question because rebuilding is going to take a lot of external support, and so far the assistance levels are not matching what appears to be the need. So that was the first earthquake, April 25th, and then, of course, as Irina just said, on Tuesday of this week, on May 12th, there was another earthquake, a 7.3 earthquake. The earthquake scale is logarithmic, so a 7.3 is many factors lower than a 7.8 earthquake, but still, part of what has happened now, and there's been a lot of aftershocks going on over the course of the last many days since April 25th. So every time there's a quake and an aftershock, buildings that might have survived weaken, their structures weaken. So the aftershocks and the second quake does continue to destabilize the infrastructure of Nepal, and that's another concern. There have been a reported 65 dead from the Tuesday earthquake. So again, it wasn't as bad of an earthquake, but the aftershocks and the ongoing problem building on to what already exists as a problem makes this an even greater cause for concern. To add to that, there's also the rains. Monsoon season is on its way. And the location of the second earthquake, Tuesday's earthquake, is apparently in an area, Namche Bazar, which is landslide prone. So now people also have to worry about the possibility of landslides, and that obviously impinges any rescue and relief effort. If I'm sure everybody on the call has seen the images that have come through both of the Kathmandu Valley, Kathmandu itself, and parts of Nepal that have been most significantly affected. Kathmandu, of course, was significantly affected, but there are two areas that were really, really hard hit. One is Sindhupalchok, and one is the Gorkha area, and a lot of the humanitarian assistance has been focused there. They've set up a coordination hubs that the UN is coordinating for relief efforts in those two areas. The images that we've seen from Sindhupalchok, I mean, you just see homes, buildings just completely destroyed in rubble. This is something that people had worried about, and the UN had launched an effort some years ago in the mid-2000s to focus on what's called a disaster risk reduction approach to trying to plan for the inevitable possibility of a major earthquake in Nepal. I say an inevitable possibility because Nepal sits really at the intersection of two tectonic plates, and there's a sort of general belief that at some point these plates, which are moving quickly, the Indic plate is moving up into the Asian plate, at some point that tension has to be released. And the last major earthquake was in 1934, so there had been a kind of general sense that at some point there would be another major earthquake. And Nepal has had, as I've said and written about elsewhere, a more limited capacity to sort of plan for reducing the risk of a theoretical earthquake that hadn't yet happened. You know, Nepal has been in a political process of transition. It was once a monarchy. It had transitioned. In fact, Nepal was in a very violent insurgency for about 10 years and successfully came out of that insurgency. It's In all of our conversation about the challenges that Nepal faces now, I do worry that people overlook the fact that, you know, it's hard to come out of an insurgency, and not all countries do this successfully. Nepal did and transitioned to a parliamentary democracy. It has a new National Assembly. The country is still trying to write its constitution, has not completed that process, and that process will likely be delayed further now that Nepalese need to focus on rebuilding and reconstruction and the many, many issues that come after a major natural disaster like a major earthquake. But it is worth noting that they have successfully come out of this political transition. They have integrated former combatants into the Nepali army. Some have retired, but that is another successful thing that has taken place. Of course, in the process of political transition, Nepal has had quite a bit of political instability, and by that I mean that they've had something like 7 prime ministers in the last 8 years. And you can imagine when you have so many prime ministers, the lack of a kind of continuity of governance means that the issues that aren't of immediate attention just sort of don't get dealt with. And that is the situation that Nepal has found itself in. People were aware of the possibility of an earthquake, but really had not been able politically to deal with trying to address in advance making the city a little bit safer. Nepalese had mounted public awareness campaigns. There's been earthquake awareness commercials. campaigns to develop a sort of Smokey the Bear type of a figure. There's a red panda that has played that iconic role of trying to warn people how to duck and cover if there is an earthquake. But again, the kind of work of trying to retrofit buildings, making sure that zoning laws are adhered to in a building process, that really hasn't been thoroughly followed through on. And the result, of course, is you see buildings that just collapse, not able to bear the kind of swaying and the stress that's put on materials in major quakes. So let me turn now and say a few words about the response. There was an immediate response from the international community. India was first off the block, which makes perfect sense because they're the largest, closest, nearest neighbor. India has been a real leader on the disaster response with Nepal. China came in as well. China has been very active with relief. Pakistan has been active providing relief. Nepal's other neighbor, Bhutan, with which it has a very difficult and strained relationship due to another issue involving the expulsion of some Nepali-speaking Bhutanese who have been refugees in Nepal for years. Bhutan actually sent in a team to provide assistance. Bangladesh sent in a team, Israel. I mean, you saw a really robust international response from the region and from countries in a larger manner. The United States immediately announced $1 million in assistance, and then 2 days after that announced another $10 million. Last week, the United States announced another $11 million. The total funding that the U.S. Has announced for humanitarian assistance to Nepal is almost $28 million now. I'm looking now at a USAID set of data. You see a good response in providing at least donations towards this overall funding goal. The UK has pledged $15 million. China has pledged $9.5 million. The Central Emergency Response Fund, which is a pooled fund managed by the UN, has almost $9 million now. Canada has pledged almost $8 million. Australia, $7 million. European Commission, $6.6 million. India, $5 million. I'm just going down the list. So you can see people are stepping up, countries are stepping up to commit. But again, if the larger goal in this flash appeal that the UN has called for is $423 million, right now, a 10% funding level is going to make it very difficult to reach the overall needs for Nepal's rebuilding. Assessments are still going on. Nobody is quite sure how much it's going to cost to rebuild Nepal. One estimate has gone as high as $10 billion. Nepal's GDP is about $20 billion, so that is a huge burden for a country that is among the poorest in the region. And I will also note, before we turn it over to Q&A and hopefully hear from participants on the call who have just been in Nepal, another area of significant concern that some of you may be tracking closely is the fact that there are UNESCO heritage sites that have been damaged. An ancient site, for example, the Swayambhunath Buddhist site in the Kathmandu Valley, it dates to the 5th century, has been damaged. There are at least 68 sites that the government of Nepal has reported as having sustained either severe or some amount of damage from the earthquake. So that's another issue that the UN UNESCO is trying to track. They're trying to inventory ancient objects that have been found so they won't be looted or so they won't be further damaged. And then when things reach a point that people can deal with rebuilding these important sites of world civilization, world heritage, at least they'll have some of the objects protected. Obviously, that pales in comparison to the humanitarian needs of so many families. I've got a lot more data here from OCHA, if we'd like to talk about that later. I don't want to drone on about data, but it just is really, it's heartbreaking to think about more than 535,000 children, 60,000 pregnant women, 637,000 adolescent girls, for example, at risk of illness, requiring special care. I mean, you can see the numbers like this and you realize what an enormous task it's going to be to rebuild. For example, at least, this is again UN data, 950,000 children in Nepal will not be able to return to school unless urgent action is taken. to assess schools in the affected districts and provide temporary learning spaces where schools are destroyed. I'm just reading here from the UN OCHA office. So on that note, why don't I just stop there, the sort of general overview. I know we have participants on the call who have just directly been in Nepal. I wish we were convening under more optimistic circumstances. This is a crisis moment for Nepal, and I know that the faith-based institutions have also been doing a lot to raise funds and to try to support this process of recovery.
Thank you, Alyssa. Let's turn now to questions and comments. And again, as Alyssa said, we know that several people on the call have just returned from the region, so we would love to hear from you and get your perspective and have a conversation. So let's open it up.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. We are currently holding for questions.
I think we have somebody queued up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Our first question comes from Bashini Lazang Drilling with Claremont School of Theology.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. Thanks to CFR and Speaker Ayers for offering the teleconference and for the participants. I'm Bikshuni Lozang Trinley, ordained Buddhist clergy and doctoral candidate, and also I'm a trained responder in CERT training by FEMA and Homeland Security. That's a community emergency response team training, incidentally. And I lived in Nepal from 98 to 2009 during the Maoist insurgency and palace massacre and transitional period out of the monarchy system there. I homesteaded two hermitage residences in the Namche area of the Upper Khumbu region of Solu Khumbu District, and my residence there is now damaged. My recent journal article on Buddhist ecofeminism culture in the Himalayas was published at International Journal of Dharma Studies by Springer Journals in March of this year. I just will give you a very brief two-minute brief that I've been having in continuous contact with locals on the ground in Nepal in central Kathmandu Valley and Solu Khumbu, North America, and supporters of relief aid in reconstruction in Southeast Asia areas like Hong Kong and Malaysia and Taiwan and Buddhist populations there. I am also in regular direct contact with Live to Love humanitarian organizations and volunteers dispensing relief aid in the ground in Nepal. The founder of that secular organization, His Holiness Gyalwang Drupa, conferenced about the Himalayas with White House staff, senators, and to Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asia, Nisha Vishwal, who is now there in Nepal and posting on Twitter. The Sherpa community on the border with Tibet Autonomous Region is in a highly strategic location, and therefore resettlement of residents is likely to be a destabilizing condition. At the same time, reconstruction there in Khumbu is extraordinarily unique compared to other parts of Nepal and full of challenges and risks. Aside from the monsoon, which she mentioned, the high altitude, no road access, unique mortarless stone masonry construction compared to brick, rebar, and cement methods elsewhere in Nepal are very different conditions. And the monsoon and snow season will be there in 6 months, monsoon season in about 6 weeks or 4 weeks. And it's also a federally protected national park with a delicate ecosystem and a robust community forestry culture. At the same time, Khumbu is a model development of Nepal, and the Reconstruction and Relief Committee members are on the ground now making further audits beyond the numbers out last week before the 7.3 scale quake hit Monday. Administrative structures at village level may not be so immediately obvious, but they actually are functional since during the whole Maoist insurgency. So I just urge everybody to really consider that point. And there's strong institutional capacity with and I'm talking especially about the Khumbu area just now, what I mentioned. It's 10 days' walk from the nearest road. Himalayan Trust, founded by Sir Edmund Hillary, was responsible for putting the airstrip in there at Lukla and the Khumjin School. And the Austrian NGO, EcoHemel, engineered and opened access to electrification through a massive hydroelectric power plant at Tame. And strong Sherpa corporate presence in Nepal aviation industry exists today. These operations are now all entirely operated indigenously, so strong capacity infrastructure for reconstruction efforts are in place, and assessments are going on for proposals alongside residents' design prototype testing by engineers, including Ubuntu Blocks engineers who worked in the Haiti earthquake reconstruction. But still, for Khumbu region on the border, the stonemason labor supply is insufficient to the demand. Numbers for damages for that area alone are 700 residential buildings demolished plus 650 needing urgent repair. Even with the enormous costs, though, they're minor compared to the cost of conflicts arising out of displacement. So reconstruction, in my view, is preferred to resettlement, except in cases of medical emergencies and injuries, including psycho-spiritual distress, as priorities for relocation. I already heard of two elders pass away from the Khumbu area community this week, so kind of secondary to the immediate trauma of the earthquakes. So my questions are, what obstacles do you see to expedited processing for local agencies to submit proposals through UN, USAID, or similar agencies or other countries long serving the region, like you just mentioned, a litany kind of the countries that have already pledged funds? And so is there going to be like an expedited counter window for processing proposals that are already audited and vetted? And then my sense and also my interest is that proposals with the most locally enfranchised accountability for evident capacity and infrastructure would be considered the healthy history construction proposals. And I'd also wish that funding could be found for proposals to deliver clinical spiritual care for trauma and recovery and integrative with medical care teams and aid on that front, and that for us to consider Nepal as like a zone of peace, and so it's an opportunity for peacemaking and collaboration. So that's all, and thank you so much for this teleconference.
Great, thank you, Alyssa.
That was an important perspective. Thank you for that. 10 days hike from the nearest road, is that what you said?
Yeah, that's right. There's an air helicopter depot at Shangbashe, and there's a smaller landing spot at Lukla and a few other places up there, of course, besides base camp, which you know about. But Lukla Airport is the nearest airstrip. And so, for example, the people were evacuated off of Everest, were some of them carried on people's like stretchers, like 3 days. Well, they can do it in like 1 or 2 days,
wow.
But foreigners usually at that altitude take 3 days at least.
Yeah, that's very isolated. So your question was about obstacles to the process of getting proposals through or expedited. Yeah,
exactly.
I have to say,
where are the bottlenecks, and how can we kind of work to make that streamlined at the local level?
I don't know how to answer that appropriately for you, because I just don't know how USAID is handling proposals for assistance. What I do know is that the bottlenecks that have been experienced so far in delivering relief have had to do with the government of Nepal. So there have been problems that have been well documented in the press where the government of Nepal has decided to apply a non-emergency mode of customs inspections to a lot of the relief materials that are all coming through the international airport, the Tribhuvan Airport. So that's held up the dispersal of a lot of assistance material, and that's been an issue. And I know that's something that the UN has been trying to impress upon the government of Nepal, to really allow the assistance to flow and not hold things up. But one bottleneck, of course, is just the size of the airport to begin with. I mean, it's not an enormous airport. There's one runway, and when there are large cargo planes coming in from many different countries, everybody just can't land and be there at once. So some of the bottlenecks have to do with just the facts on the ground.
Do you mind if just jump in before the end? In Khumbu, the stone is the main material, so it's more a question of labor on the ground versus materials, because a lot of the materials are already there.
Hmm.
And
well,
not all
the
labor
of the materials
needs to be.
We have a few more questions in queue, too, and comments,
sorry,
I just want to make sure that we get to them and maybe we could circle back.
Please. Yes, please. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sam Walthus with American Jewish World Service.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you, Alyssa and CFR, for hosting this call. I actually just returned from Nepal a day and a half ago, so I am very familiar with the landscape on the ground, and I think you depicted it really well, Alyssa. I think we're just starting to really understand the magnitude of this disaster. There are still communities in Sindelpalchuk specifically, also in Gorkha District, that actually haven't even been reached after the first earthquake. So I guess the question is, you know, 400 plus million is a drop in the bucket. It's going to take billions, which I think you referenced earlier, to rebuild. And there seems to be a huge gap between what's needed and what's being raised by various countries. Can you speak a little to that, Alyssa, and what your thoughts are around that?
Well, I think this happens not infrequently in global disasters. And that's why there is always, in fact, as you know well, there's always a gap between assistance that's pledged versus what actually gets dispersed and delivered. I am sorry to see that so early on in a flash appeal process, it is very low on the way to meeting the goal. But I think that the thing to do is try to continue to bring attention to the crisis and highlight the real needs here. But, you know, maybe some of that will become more apparent once this kind of emergency moment. I mean, right now people are still trying to deliver tarps for those who are sheltering outside of homes. But as the needs for rebuilding become more concrete, I mean, they're just beginning to do assessments. Nobody knows exactly. Again, the figures I've seen range from this sort of $5 billion to $10 billion, and that's a huge range in and of itself. So I think once there's more specificity on what exactly will need to be done to rebuild, then we'll be able to see how there could be more of an international appeal that is focused to deal with the rebuilding challenge. But I have to say that this happens. This is not unusual to see an international appeal have a number, and the what's being donated doesn't come close to matching up.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Wharton with Business Professional Network.
Hi, thank you. My question is a simple one. That is, I had heard that the main airport in Kathmandu had been damaged and was not available. Is that true, or has it been restored?
The airport, I think, was closed for some hours while there was an aftershock that caused some concern about the stability and the fidelity of the runway, but it is open now and operational and has been for most of the time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Thomas Uthup with Friends of United Nations Alliance of Civilizations.
Hi. Thank you, CFR and Ms. Ayers, for this informative talk. I had a question piggybacking a bit on this question beforehand about the aid issue. As I understand it, after the first earthquake, there was an immediate response from India, as you had mentioned. But there was also a lot of negative reaction in Nepal and among the Nepalese diaspora, because the Indian media was apparently going a bit overboard, and there was actually a hashtag called Indian Media Go Back. So, and apparently with the second earthquake, there's been a kind of a cooler reaction both from the Indian government and from Indian civil society. Is that likely to pick up, or is the Indian government and civil society likely to pick up the slack and get more aid in, or is the damage from the first reaction, lasting? Thank you.
So here I have been following this issue, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably pretty important to distinguish between the reaction to the government's immediate assistance response and its provision of humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, and the Indian media and the way the Indian media, which in some cases I gather was embedded with some of the Indian troops who were providing assistance, the Indian media and how they were covering this. The hashtag and the backlash was specifically focused on Indian media, not on the Indian government's response. In fact, if you there are some stories in the press that are quite interesting. You'll find people quoted as saying the Indian government is reacting so quickly it's making our government look bad or look non-responsive by comparison. I think what Nepalis were reacting to with the Indian media is a sense that the Indian media was covering this perhaps nationalistically with a focus on rescue efforts, rescuing Indians who are in Nepal. And that happens. There's always a lot of attention. In the United States, there was a lot of attention to the sad case of the Google executive who perished on Mount Everest. And that is a tragedy. But, of course, that is one person, and Nepal has lost more than 8,000. So I think it was kind of that sense that the Indian media was very sort of self-referential and focusing on India and what India had done to help Nepal, but more importantly focused only on the rescue of Indian citizens when Nepal is in a severe state of crisis and has enormous needs at this point and needs all the help that it can get from around the world.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can press star 1 at this time. Okay, we have no further questions in the queue.
Alyssa, as Nepal rebuilds, what are the most important steps the country can take to decrease vulnerability to future earthquakes and natural disasters?
So this is a big challenge, and Nepal is going to have to focus on this. In some of the areas that are the poorest, where you have homes that are built just of stone and wood, it is not probably going to be possible to create something that's fully seismic resistant if you're talking about building just a small structure on the hills. But some of the areas that collapsed more in the valley where you saw older brick and wood structures and some stone and cement structures, one of the issues there is how buildings were constructed. Were there in an area zoned, let's say, for two stories, did somebody just go ahead and build six more floors on top of it, and it doesn't matter because nobody is checking, even though you're not supposed to do that from the zoning? So there's that kind of consideration. But there's also the consideration of thinking about whether there's, you know, one of the, in Kathmandu, one of the traditional kinds of homes that are built, you'll have homes that are built on a courtyard, and they all open onto the courtyard, and there will be kind of one doorway that's the exit point. But that doorway then is a point of vulnerability. If you have structures that collapse in, it makes it more difficult for people to try to make their way out if that courtyard is the only exit. So I would imagine as people start to review and rebuild, that will be a consideration. Is there an open enough space? If it is built on a courtyard, are people going to be caught under smaller tunnels as the exit path? Is there a way to even with that traditional structure, have a more open exit so there isn't a kind of vulnerability to building collapse, trapping people inside just rubble and destroyed material?
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lauren Levy with the University of North Carolina.
Hi. Do I need to do something?
Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Can you hear me?
No, we can hear you.
Oh, good. Okay. I didn't realize suddenly I wasn't sure. This is the first time I've been on one of these calls. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to do something. So I got back on Monday night from Nepal. I'm an anthropologist in the Department of Religious Studies, and I've been working in Nepal for the past 25 years, both with Buddhists and now most recently with new Christian communities. I actually live in one of, just as a point of reference, I'm sabbatical and have been doing research there now. I'm just home for a little bit of sanity building before going back in 2 weeks, and I live in one of these courtyard buildings that you discussed. What's amazing is that if you look at the planning that was done for earthquake preparation, most of it, as I understand it, was actually focused on the idea that the disaster would happen in Kathmandu and in the urban areas. My courtyard building did not collapse, although I had sort of steeled myself to walk over whatever it took if that was the only way out. But it was the rural areas, which everybody seemed to think would do fine, that were actually the hardest hit. And while planning for future earthquakes, we'll certainly have to think about the urban infrastructure. I mean, I think right now the some of the humanitarian struggle is that, as I understand it, and maybe other people know more, there really wasn't a good plan for the kind of destruction that's happened in the remote rural regions that they got. And then these landslides have cut things off even farther. So what I wanted to ask, and I don't, I'm wondering if this is going to appropriate for a conference call like this, but I thought I would give it a try in any case, is, and I looked at the list of people who were participating, and there are so many folks who are involved with religious organizations that may themselves be involved with aid, or may know folks at organizations who are involved in the relief effort. And I'm wondering what people know about how this is, how the relief is taking place, and how the sensitivity of religious differences is being thought about here in the U.S. as we think about delivering aid to Nepal. And the reason that I ask this is I was in Kathmandu for the quake, but within 4 days I was back out in Gorkha. I didn't reach the epicenter, but Gorkha is one of my major field sites. And so I was walking, you know, around with in the areas, in very, very, very hard-hit areas where I knew folks, trying to get a sense of the scale of the damage and who would need what. And I was doing that with a female pastor who I've been working with out there. And we were very, very careful to make it clear to communities, because these are religiously and ethnically and caste mixed communities, that any aid that we, you know, any information that we got, we would share with everyone. And we were not delivering aid specifically, you know, just to the Christians. But people were asking about it. And there is a sense in Nepal already, because the government is so concerned with bolstering its own power by delivering funds to its own party members in general, and this is continuing during the quake, and because you know, people do tend to work in networks that they know and with their own communities, there's a real fear, I think, or a reasonable fear, within communities that are diverse but coexistent, happily, more or less happily coexistent, that the politics, the micropolitics of aid delivery may complicate these peaceful relations that folks have managed to establish, because, say, Christian organizations will just give to Christians, or Buddhist organizations will privilege Buddhists, and they think human rights organizations will privilege Dalits, and so on, like this. And I wondered if this was something that Americans who are involved in the aid-giving process with religious commitments are thinking about.
Thank you so much. Alyssa, I don't know if you want to make a comment. We have a few more questions in queue, and others may want to respond to Lauren's
Sure, just one quick comment before others respond, but it's certainly the case, I mean, and you provided a kind of an immediate firsthand recollection of exactly what kind of perceptions are going on there, but the UN has reported that they are hearing about problems of caste discrimination in camps and spontaneous sites where people are staying. So this is clearly an issue that the UN is aware of. Now, how that will be translated into making sure that, that assistance is provided in a non-discriminatory or, you know, an across-the-board basis. I am not sure how the UN is planning to manage that, but obviously they're aware of this as an issue.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sepal Singh with State University of New York at Buffalo.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. As you mentioned, the assistance available after such a disaster generally falls far short of the need, at least initially. Is there any possibility or any thoughts on if some international structure can be set up to do it better and more quickly in case of any future tragedies of such type? Thanks.
Well, you've just asked the most important question about humanitarian assistance worldwide. I mean, the UN is the international structure to try to coordinate and make sure that it is pulling together the efforts of all governments as well as non-governmental actors who are working to provide assistance. I mean, non-governmental actors are quite active in this space. If you take a look at the USAID website, they've got a long list of organizations that citizens can give to provide help if they'd like to, and it's a very long list. But yeah, it's UN OCHA that is this point of coordination. Structures do exist. I wish that the needs were funded at the level of flash appeal. I mean, that would be a perfect world. Our world isn't perfect, unfortunately. So I'm not sure that even a creation of a new kind of an institution would solve this problem.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we are just about out of time, so I'm sorry to those of you whose questions we could not get to. But if you have other thoughts that you want to share with Alyssa or resources you want to share with the group, please email us at outreach@cfr.org. Alyssa, thank you very much for doing this. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing attention to the crisis and the needs in Nepal. And I think all of us on the call will continue to think about what we can do to try to help.
And we encourage you all to follow CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements, and also follow Alyssa's commentary and analysis at AYRES Alyssa. It's AYRESALYSSA. So thank you all again, and we look forward to your participation in future discussions.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.